Mała Wielka Firma. Podcast dla biznesu, rozwoju i przyjemności słuchania.
Skąd wziąć pomysł na biznes i jak się upewnić, że da się na nim zarobić? W tym odcinku odpowiemy na pytania, z którymi zmaga się wiele osób planujących i prowadzących własne firmy.
Zaprasza Marek Jankowski.
To jest odcinek 220 i jest on wyjątkowy z co najmniej dwóch powodów. Po pierwsze, mam jedynego w swoim rodzaju gościa. Był jednym z pierwszych podcasterów, których słuchałem i których wciąż podziwiam. Po drugie, rozmawiamy po angielsku, ale przygotowałem też wersję wideo z polskimi napisami. Znajdziesz ją pod adresem maławielkafirma.pl/220. Na tej samej stronie możesz też przeczytać całą rozmowę po polsku. Powtarzam, maławielkafirma.pl/220. Pod koniec odcinka opowiem Ci więcej o kulisach tej rozmowy, ale teraz już nie chcę przeciągać, bo myślę, że to prawdziwa petarda. Panie i panowie, gościem Małej Wielkiej Firmy jest dziś jeden z najpopularniejszych biznesowych podcasterów na świecie, Pat Flynn. Hi Pat, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. And let's start with my usual opening question. What did you read recently?
Oh, I'm reading this book right here in front of me. It's called Getting Everything You Can Out of All You've Got by Jay Abraham. And it's an old book. And by old, I mean it was published in the year 2000. But the principles of marketing and sales are all in here. I wish I read this book a while back, but it's great. Very easy to read. And it's right where I'm at in my business right now, which is, you know, learning how to get better at selling a message and sharing information in a way that people can then take action on.
Is there anything in this book you've never had before?
Yeah, I mean, the section I'm in right now is talking about the guarantees that you might put in a sale. You often see them on TV or whenever you're selling something, you know, 30-day money-back guarantee, those kinds of things. That's kind of one level of reducing a person's risk and making them feel more comfortable buying from you. But there are other interesting ways to do that. You can, you know, he's talking about some examples of some people who say, hey, if you're not satisfied with this product, we'll give you your money back and we'll double that money. So you'll actually get more money back if you don't like this product. So basically sharing with a person who might buy from you that you are so confident in this product that you will even pay them double the money back if they don't buy. Also including things like if you offer a bonus, this is very common on television, but not so common online. You know, you buy this thing, it includes a bonus. If you don't like the product, you send it back, but you get to keep the bonus. So that's another way to reduce the risk that a person might feel with a purchase that they're going to make.
This is good, yeah. Today, I'd like to talk with you about coming up with business ideas and validating them. And of course, this is your topic. You wrote a whole book about it. It's called Will It Fly? And it's been recently published in Poland. By the way, do you know the Polish title?
No, I've seen the book. I've seen it shared multiple times. I don't even want to try to pronounce it because I know I'm going to get it wrong.
It's Gotowi na start, which means ready to start. From my experience, there are two basic types of business ideas. Type one is based on the founder's skills, expertise, passion. Type two is based on their observation about customers' needs. And my question is, where should they start if they don't have both, if their skills don't match the market demand?
Well, obviously, the ideal situation would be where you have a skill and people want that skill, right?
Yeah.
But actually, even before any of that, there's a third part to this, which is the start of the book, which is going into, well, what do you want? Because you might have a great skill and it might even be in demand, but if you don't want to do that kind of business, then it's not going to make you happy. And it's not, you're not going to put your full 100% effort behind it either. So a lot of the exercises in the front of the book kind of do some thought experiments to have you understand, okay, well, what kind of business makes sense for you? Because, you know, a lot of people might be really good at teaching something and there might be a demand for it. So they might do live workshops because maybe they heard that that's what they should do. And then they do them and they just aren't good with other people in person. So even though they have a good idea and a skill and it's in want, they didn't land on a way to do it that makes sense for who they are. So they might instead prefer to do it online or virtually on a call like this, or even in an online course, for example. So aligning what you do with where you want to be is the most important part, because I know, and I've interviewed a lot of entrepreneurs who are very successful. On paper, they're doing something that is making a lot of money. They have a lot of employees. They're helping a lot of people. But when I talk to them and get deep into what's going on, they go, you know, I'm just not fulfilled. And I'm like, you're an entrepreneur. You are a business owner. You get to choose where you want to go. Why would you choose a place where you don't want to be or you're not perfectly happily fulfilled? That's not to say that every business should only be unicorns and rainbows the entire way where everything's happy. No, no, no. What I'm saying is if the end goal doesn't match your end goal, then there's going to be a disconnect there and it's not going to be good. You know, a lot of people, the analogy I like to use is a ladder. You know, it takes a lot of effort to climb a ladder. You have to let go of a hand or a leg in order to climb. But what if you're at the top of the ladder and you realize you're at the wrong ladder? You're in a place that you don't want to be. So before you start climbing, let's figure out where our destination is first. So that's the most important thing. Now, if you have either a skill that you can offer and you know that this is a skill that you could potentially find people for, I wouldn't discount a Google search. Some people just do a Google search and they go, oh, there's nobody searching for it, so it must not be a good idea. The most important thing is you want to have conversations. And this is a big thing that I talk about in the book that challenges a lot of people right away, is that you have to have conversations about your ideas of what you want to do with other people. Potentially and ideally with people who are in that space who may align. So if you're a parent, for example, and you want to potentially teach parents how to keep their kids from wetting the bed or something, you talk to other parents and go, hey, is that something you'd be interested in trying to figure out how to solve? Have you tried to solve that before? In what ways have you tried to solve it? What worked? What didn't work? And that's going to give you a lot of information up front before you even start building anything. You're learning so that you can take the guesswork out of it. That's this whole thing about getting ready to go. Is being ready is knowing that you're headed in the right direction. It's just like when you get into a car, you type in the navigation or the address you want to go in, and now your car is kind of set to go in that path. And if you go off path, well, your car is going to tell you to go back to the main street so you can get back, or do a U-turn to get back to where you were. It's where people go, you know what, I'm going to give this a shot. I think it might work. We'll see what happens. They build it. They try to sell it. And they go, well, nobody's buying it. Well, I guess I'm a failure. I'm going to go back to my 9-to-5 job. And that's tough, because it's good that you took action, but because you didn't prepare yourself a little bit beforehand, you don't know why that thing failed. You don't know if it was because it was a bad idea. You don't know if it was because just in the way that you shared it or who you shared it with. You don't know if it's just the price. There's nobody to talk to. So if you have conversations, you find interested parties, you can talk to them. Then you go and build a prototype or some sort of idea of what this thing will be. And you actually get them to commit to pay for it even before you build it. That's what this whole book is about. It's about validating ideas, because, you know, even with me, Merrick, like I have a lot of friends who I talk to with businesses and I go, hey, like I have this idea. Would you buy that? And a lot of times our friends and family want to help us feel good, right?
Yeah.
So they'll say, oh yeah, of course, that's a great idea. I would totally buy that. And then you build it and then you ask them to buy it. And they're like, you know, I actually don't, you know, I didn't think you'd actually build it. Or, you know, I don't really need it. I was just trying to make you feel better. So before you build it, you can ask people in those interested parties whether they would actually buy this, and you get them to buy it. I think it was Tim Ferriss who said the best way to validate an idea is to get them, is to ask them to buy something, not if they would buy something, but you ask them to buy it. And a lot of people, when I tell them this, are like, that's weird. Like, why would people pay for something up front before they even have it? And it's because this is something that happens all the time. We just hadn't thought of doing this with our own business ideas. When you pay for an event, you don't hear about the event the day the event happens. You hear about it way in advance and you buy tickets ahead of time. And that's how the people who put on the event know. They know ahead of time if it's going to work or not, because they've filled seats for it or not. Kickstarter, people are paying for ideas that aren't even made yet. They're just people's random ideas, or they started the process. And so they're getting some people to back those campaigns to pay for finishing that idea and manufacturing that thing. And if the campaign doesn't work, then good. They know they saved a lot of money by not building the thing first. So that's kind of where it's at.
All right. It's relatively easy today to check the market demand, or at least to find out what customers are interested in, because you simply do a Google search, as you said. It's much more difficult, I think, to find out what you want. You can't do Google search for your own thoughts.
Right, so, in your own heart and soul,
exactly.
Right?
So what's the way to learn what's the right path for you? What will be fulfilling for you?
Cool. So this is in the book, but I'm going to tell you all how to do this right now. So the first test is something I call the airport test. And I got this strategy in terms of inner thinking from a company here in the US called Keller Williams Realty. And Jay Papasan is a guy who works with that company. And when they hire people, they do this exercise to make sure there's a good marriage between the potential employee and the company. And so what he does is he brings people in and he goes, hey, fold this piece of paper into four. So you have a piece of paper folded into sections or quadrants in half in both ways. And then in each quadrant, you write down one of the four most important areas of your life. So the first question is like, what's important to you? You write those things down. So it might be family, it might be finances, it might be health and fitness, it might be something else. Maybe you're into music and you write down music. So just the top four areas of your life that you want to focus on. And here's the experiment. You're at the airport 5 years from now. You're waiting for a flight. Maybe it's delayed a little bit. And then you feel a tap on your shoulder and it's one of your friends from a long time ago. You haven't seen them in a very long time. And they go, wow, I can't believe you're here. It's incredible. I haven't seen you in so many years. How's life? How's life going? And you respond with, life is amazing. It couldn't get any better. And the exercise here is, what in each of these four areas of life would make you say that? So again, 5 years down the road, what would make you say that life couldn't get any better? So in your family life, 5 years from now, you write down bullet points. What would make you say that life couldn't get any better related to your family life? Then your finances, what would make you say life couldn't get any better with your finances? And then your health and fitness, or whatever the four categories are. And you look at this sheet that you create. And what they did is in this Keller Williams Realty, they would look at the answers that people put and go, we can help you get that. We can work together to help you achieve your goals in 5 years. Or they would go, wow, I didn't realize that you wanted to be mayor of your town one day. I didn't realize that you wanted to do this and that and travel the world. If you work here, we're not going to be able to support you with that because you'd have to do this, this, and this. So I'm glad we had this conversation. You wouldn't want to work here. And we wouldn't want to hire you. It's not going to work out. So let's talk about this now instead of 5 years down the road when neither of us are happy with each other's performances, right? So this is the same thing, you and where you want to go in your life. You look at this sheet that you created, and any decisions that you make moving forward, you go, okay, does that decision align with, does that business idea align with my family, my whatever the four quadrants are? And that exercise alone, if that's the only thing you do, that can teach you so much about where you want to go. And some of you listening to this might be like, whoa, that's just a five-year plan, a fancy five-year plan. Kinda, but because it's in context of an actual conversation that you might be having with a friend in the future who's asking you, how's life now? You're able to think about it in a more tangible way because you're thinking about your own life in all these aspects of life. So that's the first thing. That's gonna help tell you yes or no to certain decisions. Because I've, for example, have come across many opportunities. And as you grow a business, as you get to become an entrepreneur, more and more opportunities come your way. And if you're like most people, you're going to say yes to a lot of them and probably say yes to way too many and potentially even get burned out, which happens a lot. The trick is understanding when to say no to things, even though those opportunities are great. So for example, I had a company reach out to me. They wanted to partner with me to be a really high level person at a hosting company. So in my business, I help people build websites, and it would make sense for me to own or be in charge of a hosting company. It would be very easy for me to sell that to my audience who's building websites. Oh, by the way, I have this hosting company, then you can trust it. But it doesn't make sense for me because it doesn't align with my life 5 years from now. I don't want to go into an office every day. I don't want to be in charge of a team of 500 people and servers, and the customer service aspect of that just gives me a headache thinking about it. So it's a very easy no, even though that business could probably make millions of dollars. It's not worth sacrificing to do that versus what I know aligns with my sheet of paper there.
Let's get back to customers. Let's assume we know where the pain points are, but even if we know them, they may still not want to buy our product. Mm-hmm. What can we do to improve our chances? You mentioned testing the product or the idea, building a prototype, but I don't think it's always that easy.
No, it's not easy. First of all, it's not easy. I don't want to make it seem like tomorrow you could have a $1 million idea. This takes time, but it's the people who spend the time to do the right research to validate these ideas. Those are the people who will be more likely to succeed. I'm not saying that if you do this, you will even land on an idea that works. Part of this process, Merrick, is you go through this process in stages. You might get to a stage where you realize, wow, this is not going to work. And so you just abandon it at that point and you can start again. And it's so great to realize that now or early and not years later when you're like, I spent all this money, my life savings on this. And if only I knew, is what a lot of people say. If only I knew this wasn't going to work. You can know if it's not going to work sooner than you think. And so that's part of this process too. But validating is interesting. Because if you go through the stages, and stage one is you have these conversations, you find out who might be interested in it. If you can't find anybody who even wants to talk to you about that thing, then you already, that's your stopping point. Something has to change, either the way you talk about it, like that's your area of focus. Can I even get people to talk to me about this? Then the next step would be, okay, the people I talk to, would they be interested in learning more? And do they want help? Because sometimes people need the help, but they just don't want it. So finding that urgency is really important. That's stage two. And that's where you go, okay, I can't even get anybody to say, yeah, like send me more info if you have it, or, you know, I can't get any emails, or nobody even wants to learn or help themselves about this. Well, now I know it's time to abandon it. Or you go, wow, okay, I have people now who go, yeah, tell me what you're going to find out, or tell me what solutions are available, or yes, I need help desperately. That's okay. Green light, move to the next step. And the next step is you create a solution based on these conversations that you feel would be best for them. And there's a lot of different ways to determine what that solution might be. You can look at the market already and say, hey, there's these products out there that already solve that problem, but they could be done much better or they should be different. And since you're the one talking to those people, you can even say, hey, you know, there are solutions out there. Have you tried this? What did you like about it? What did you not like about it? And the great thing is you can even go to Amazon for physical products, and there are people who are telling the public what they like about it and what they don't like about it. These are in the reviews of Amazon, right? And you can get a sense for how popular these products are as well based on the number of reviews, but also just the quality of the product. And actually the best place to go are the 3-star reviews, because the 3-star reviews are a fantastic goldmine of information. Because the 3-star reviews, you will literally see people go, I like this product because X, Y, and Z. I don't like this product because A, B, C, or whatever. And so that's telling you information that you can use as you start building your thing. If it's an online product or a software, you can find people talking about it in forums. You can even find conversations on social media about people using that product. You can go and see what people are asking about or what features people are requesting. Like that's public conversation that's happening right now. Facebook groups, LinkedIn groups, Twitter, Instagram, people are tagging and using hashtags. You can find those conversations and that's going to give you a lot of information. So then you create a prototype of the solution. If it's an online course or something like a software, your prototype would essentially just be a drawing of it or an outline of it. It doesn't have to be an actual working thing yet. Most prototypes don't work, but they give a person an idea of what it might be like if it were to work. That's the purpose of that. Because now you have these interesting people. You wouldn't have got to this stage yet if you didn't find these interested parties. And so you have this prototype, you share it with them. You go, what do you think of this? Is this something that you would use? What's missing? What do you like about it? All those kinds of things. And then you go and go, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to sell this. And if I get 20 people to pay for it now, I will build it. If I can't, well, then there's a problem. But here's the thing. When you pre-sell that thing, if you don't make that cutoff number, then it's not over. You have people who said they were interested, who enjoyed the prototype, but didn't buy you up, didn't buy that offer. Now you have people you can go back to and say, well, why not? And they will tell you the next steps. Oh, I didn't buy it because, you know, it's too big. Okay. Well, what if we made it shorter? Would you do it then? Okay. Then you make it shorter. Okay. Here you go. Now I'm still not interested. Oh, well, you said it was cause it was smaller, but you're not telling me the full story. Tell me why this doesn't make sense to you now. Oh, well, you know, I think it's too expensive. Well, when people say something is too expensive, it's not the price that they're worried about. They don't believe it has as much value as you are charging. So it's a messaging problem when it becomes price. So there's things you learn along the way, and then you can kind of reiterate, try again, and keep going. And then, of course, if you get to a point where it's just not making sense for you anymore, some people get to that point where they have the thing, and they're like, they do the market research, and they see all the other people in the space that are also serving this audience. And that's sometimes when they realize, I don't really like being in this niche anymore. I don't want to serve this audience. And so you learn along the way, and that's how you can do it. And several businesses are doing it that way. And this is how I validated my book. I got people who were in a specific segment of my audience to download a small topic based PDF file about the same topic. If nobody downloaded that PDF, then that would tell me that this is not something people want to learn more about. But because they downloaded it, and because I got feedback, that then turned into the book, Will It Fly? And so there's a classic example. So Jay Abraham, actually the guy who wrote this book, getting everything you can out of all you got. There's this very famous thing he did back before the internet days. So he's written a lot of books, but think about this. Before the internet, he used validation tactics like this. He was thinking about what book to write next. And so to help him decide what book to write next, he bought classified ads in the newspaper, one for each of the five books that he was thinking of writing, and then selling them and basically saying, hey, if you want to buy this book, call this phone number and we'll let you know where you can get it. Now, these books weren't even made yet. He didn't even have an outline for them. It was just simply based on the title and the tagline of the book. And so he got calls. And the one book that got more calls than others, that told him that that's the book he should write. So how does this work? It kind of seems like lying, right? Kind of, but here was the position. He would collect the information from the people and go, okay, well, when this book comes out, I will sell it to you. Or the people who were calling about the other books, he would go, well, this book is not available yet, but when it becomes available, if it ever does, we'll let you know about it. So some people might argue that, well, that's kind of lying, but he was being truthful the entire time, and he was able to understand which book he should write next. So he was getting validation. He was getting people to tell him for him what he should do next. He wasn't guessing anymore.
Yeah, and I think, of course, you can always say it's lying, but on the other hand, you still give your customers value. You still deliver this book if they vote for it, if they want to buy it. So. Right. It's nothing wrong about it.
Right. And he didn't charge people. It was the fact that they called. That was the transaction. The fact that they got a phone, dialed the number, and called. That you don't do that unless you're interested in that book and actually want to buy it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Tim Ferriss did another experiment that was very similar. And this was back when he wrote the 4-Hour Workweek. He talked about this. So he built a website and he was selling some clothing product of some kind, and there was pictures of it, and there was a buy now button. And when you click the buy now button, it says, great, thank you for your interest and your email. We're currently out of stock, which is truthful, right? They don't have it in stock.
Yeah.
But the thing is, he didn't have any stock ever yet. So I don't agree with that. I prefer to go. So basically he would consider, okay, well, how many people clicked to buy? That gives me insight. as to whether I should do this. For me, I prefer to go, hey, I haven't built this online course yet. I'm thinking of building it. Pay here. You'll get early access to it. You'll be the first customers, and I will work with you to build it in the way that you want. And you'll get early access to me. And that's good for me because I'm being honest. They get early access and they get to be the first people who get that information. And what's really cool about that for me is I just help 20 people. If 20 people get in, then great. They're helping me build it in the way that it needs to be. I'm talking to them. They're guiding me through what they need instead of a lot of people who build online courses. They spend 3 months filming videos, filming other things and creating the course. And then they go, they launch it. And even if they get people in, there might be parts of that course that are unnecessary or confusing. Now, as you're building it with somebody, it's not confusing because you're checking in with them all the time. And then by the end, you have people who have successfully gone through the course. You now have testimonials. And now you can go public with confidence, knowing that this thing worked. It was built specifically for that group. And you can knock it out of the park.
Yep. Some say that if you love doing something, you shouldn't make it your work, your job. What's your take on that? Do you think that it's a good idea to turn passion into a business?
It can be, but it could also ruin it for you. I think this is a very smart thing to consider. I have a friend who is very big into snowboarding. She snowboards here in San Diego, or not in San Diego, but in California, as much as she can. Whenever the first inch of snow comes, she's snowboarding. It's her passion. She had an opportunity, because she's kind of a big name, to create a snowboarding clothing line. And she jumped on it quickly. She's a woman who loves fashion and a snowboarder. She can combine two of her passions together, fashion and snowboarding. After 6 weeks of working with a company on fashion and design and the logistics of all of it, she just wasn't having fun anymore. So she quit. She stopped because she's like, I'm not having fun snowboarding. But I also know other people who have a passion, a hobby. They start podcasting about it. They start blogging about it. They get a whole following of other people who love that thing too. And this guy, he puts on events where he brings all the other people in that same space together and they have a great time. He absolutely loves it. And he's making money by charging for tickets to these events. So you have to align how you want to do things with what you want to do. That's where the magic is, right? Because the first example, she loved those things, but that's not how she wanted to do those things. The second example, he loved those things, and the how in the business related even more to what he loved about that thing, the people part of it, the connections and whatnot. That's something that's really important to consider. So taking your passions and building a business off of that is fine as long as the way you're building your business still aligns with you and your passions and still remains fun for you and still can be something that you will enjoy. And where I recommend people do is to do these thought experiments again. Okay, let's say that you do go with your business, with your passion. 5 years from now, it's successful. What would you have to do? What are you doing like on a regular day's basis? Does that day, is that something you want? If it is, awesome. If not, then, well, good thing we're talking about this now. Maybe that's not where you want to go. So I think it just depends on how you structure how you run the business and what that business becomes.
I know people who always look for brand new, original business ideas, something that's never been done before. Is it safe and is it still possible to create such business? Maybe some rare cases, I think, but as I can see, most successful businesses are improvements of other existing businesses. So in your opinion, from your knowledge, is it good to start something brand new, original, or rather play safe and open another coffee shop, digital marketing agency, and things like this?
Well, when you have a brand new idea, like totally brand new, first of all, that's just hard to find in the first place because most things that come out now are iterations of things that have already existed. But we'll talk about that in a minute. Brand new ideas, it's tough because you have nothing to base your success off of. There's no previous companies that you could look and say, oh, well, what did they do that I could do differently or better?
Yeah, no benchmarks.
There's none of that.
Yeah.
A lot of brand new business ideas are challenging also because the consumers have never seen anything like that before. So you have to educate them at the same time.
Yeah, they don't understand it. Yeah.
They don't understand it, right? And it's hard because we understand it. We came up with the idea, but we have what's called the curse of knowledge. When you know something,
yeah,
it's hard to know what it's like to not know that thing anymore. So that there's some huge challenges there. There have been obviously things that have been successful even recently with brand new ideas. There's been brand new ideas that were supposed to revolutionize and change the world that kind of just blah,
yeah,
when they launched. For example, the Segway. The Segway was a brand new idea. Nobody's going to walk anymore. We're all going to use these rolly things with handles to walk around town. And now the only time I see them is when I go to destination cities and there's tours along the ocean.
yeah.
Right? That's not what their business model was when they started out. That's what it became. So they pivoted. But that's brand new ideas. Let's take another example of an old idea that has been reimagined and is doing really well now. Some might argue against that. But think of cars. Cars have been around since the early 1900s. And there's been all different kinds of cars. Let's talk about Tesla. They didn't do anything new in terms of a thing. The car has already existed forever, but what did they do to it? They added things to it that are what people are looking for today. So electric, efficient, non-pollution, just fast, stylish, right? And we could even talk about Elon Musk and how he validated that idea. So he went to, the way he validated that was like, hey, I have this idea. I want to make electric cars. And I think everybody in America should, or in the world, should have electric cars. He thought about, and he actually talked to people, and the first thing people said was, nobody's going to want electric cars because they're slow, because they're crappy, because you'd have to charge them, like, you know, they'll only last 15 minutes on a charge. So what did he do? He actually took the body of a Lotus, put some electronic components in it, called it Tesla, and said, hey, you all said we couldn't make a fast car and we couldn't have battery life longer than an hour. You're wrong. Look at this. And then everybody got really excited because that opened their mind, right? So he didn't take something new, like invent a totally brand new thing. He took something that existed, wanted to make it better, crushed those objections, showed people, and that was called the Tesla Roadster. And now there's a version 2.0 of a Tesla Roadster coming out. But then, but it was funny because then he was like, okay, like fast car, great. But nobody's going to buy that because it's too expensive. Well, he's like, oh, well, I think I can make a car that's still kind of expensive, but the higher class people would buy that would be stylish and sleek. And that's where the Tesla Model S came. And so he validated that, yeah, people at that high level wanted these cars. And so then that turned into the Model X, and then now the Model 3 came out recently, which is that was his big plan, was to have mass market, cheap, quote, relatively cheap electric cars, which are the Model 3s. But it took those iterations to get there. Now, if you have, so basically to answer your question, I'd recommend starting with the problems that people have and the pains that they're going through. That's where you want to start. Have conversations, learn all about those problems as much as possible. The better you can learn about those pains and problems, the easier it is going to be for you to create or find a solution for them. Once you understand that, find out what is there that is already trying to help solve those problems. Make something better. That's the answer. Make something better, make something different, do it in a different way. But you don't have to innovate completely brand new to win either. The other thing about this is you don't have to create what's called a blockbuster hit to be successful too. There's an article called 1,000 True Fans by a guy named Kevin Kelly. This was written back in 2006, I think, but it's an article that was written for musicians and artists and, you know, creatives, and entrepreneurs fit in there as well. And he basically said, you know, a lot of people, when they come up with ideas or they try to be a musician, they try to be like the next Aerosmith or the next Elvis or the next Bon Jovi, the next big, huge star. And you can still be a very successful musician or artist or entrepreneur if you don't try to focus on being the next A-list celebrity, but just being somebody who has 1,000 true fans. Because if you think about it math-wise, if you have 1,000 true fans are people who are going to buy all your albums or buy all your products or all your art pieces, who just will support you no matter what. They love you so much, they'll fly out to see you just because you're going to be having a coffee meetup. Like those kinds of people. If you just had 1,000 of those people and they pay you $100 a year, just $100 a year. Some of us pay $100 a month for things like cable television that we don't even consume. $100 a year to support something that you truly love. Not impossible. You have a six-figure business right there already, right? 1,000 times 100. And yeah, I mean, that's just a hypothetical example, but it really shows you that you can be successful in a small space if you are the person, the guy, the gal, the business, the go-to product, the go-to software. You don't need a blockbuster hit to win. And I think that article was very successful because it made people feel like, wow, I don't have to be on every single news channel. I could still be successful. And I think that's very encouraging for entrepreneurs too. If you just have 1,000 people who follow you, maybe your space is so niched that there are only 1,000 people in that could even fit that bill, but you are the go-to person. So a good example is, you know, I coach a lot of people in their business. I had a person who wanted to do dog training. She's a dog trainer, and that's her passion, dogs and helping people get more comfortable with their dogs. But she has a specialty, and her specialty is helping dogs who are really aggressive, who want to bite you, those kind of, like, you know, vicious dogs. That's her special power. And so she has this business helping with dog training, but she knows that this is her superpower. So we positioned her as not just a regular dog trainer of all dogs, but now the person who is the go-to person for really vicious dogs that can hurt you and hurt your family. And now what's really cool is because that's her position, she knows who to go to. Now her audience is, well, if you have a vicious dog, I'm your gal. And now what's really cool is she's getting featured on other podcasts with dog trainers who have massive audiences who don't have that specialty. They're inviting her and going, hey, you know, I have people in the audience who likely really need your help. Share your information. And then now they are getting into her world. And because they found her, like, she's become their more mentor kind of person. So that's just an example of, again, the riches are in the niches, or as you guys say, niches. You can be more successful by narrowing your field too.
They invite her because they don't consider her as a competitor. But
correct,
most of us do have competitors, and it's not easy to you know, compete, especially at the beginning when you are a new venture, you have no followers, no huge brand. Where should I look for my competitive advantages at the beginning when I start?
Yeah, I mean, even before your idea becomes fully fleshed out, you should have done some market research. In the book, you'll see an exercise I call creating your market map. And this is where you come up with your three P's. The first P is a list of all the places where your target audience, the people with these problems, exist. So you list all the blogs and the forums and the websites and the communities and the events, online, offline, all those things. The second column is the people. These might be considered your competitors, but you have to notice that they might also be considered your partners and your colleagues. So you write down all the people that you find, the people who have already earned that influence with that target audience, the people who are already there serving them. Then the last column is the products, the things that they're already buying. And this market map alone can give you some good insight into that particular space. It tells you kind of where people are, which you can go back to later, and maybe that's where you guest post, or that's where you do research to learn about what's popular in that space right now. You have a list of all the people. These are all the other top players and influencers in the space, which are going to give you a good idea of not who your competitors are necessarily, but who you should be building a relationship with, who you should be saying hello to, who you should be trying to convince that you have a specialty in that space that they should be thankful to have on their show or featured, not threatened by it. And then finally, all the products, which gives you some insight for, well, here's some of the solutions that people are trying, or here are the price points that people are paying. Here are the products I could potentially promote as an affiliate too and partner with as well. So that market map exercise can give you some good insight into the space for sure. But when it comes to competitive advantages, really it comes with understanding what the superpower is that this business is going to have that others don't. This is called your USP or unique selling proposition. Something that in one sentence or two sentences you could share with somebody that would make them go, oh, well, that's why I would want to go with you. Because if you just build something like everybody else, they're going to go to the people who are already established. But you have to be a little bit more niche down and more focused on what your superpower is, such that you won't become a competitor, but you'll be seen as an asset. So this podcasting dog training example I was giving you, these podcasting people are inviting her on the show because she is an asset. She has knowledge that he does not have. These podcasters don't have fully understanding. So they're able to better serve their audience. So this person who has the very niche dog training, the very vicious dog training thing, she is seen as somebody who could even help a competitor because now his brand is able to help the people who have that particular need. But understanding what your superpower is, and I think there's another exercise that we could do together, which will help you understand what your superpowers are. And this is the thought experiment I use in the book is, have you ever seen this show Shark Tank, where people go and they pitch their ideas to investors?
Yeah.
If you've seen that in the U.S., and I know different countries have different versions of that, but in the U.S. it's called Shark Tank.
Yeah, in the U.K. it's Dragon's Den.
Dragon's Den, that's right.
It was also on Polish TV.
So in the U.S., there's this guy named Kevin Harrington, who's one of the investors, and they call him Mr. Wonderful, and he always asks a lot of the same questions. So one question that he always asks people is, well, why don't I just hire somebody to do that, and I'll just, you know, crush you in the competition? Why do I need you? Basically, what he's asking there is, like, what makes you so special? Why should I invest in you? What's unique about being in this partnership versus me just finding some other random person to create that same product or do the same thing that you're doing? And this is a very, very important thing to consider. If you walk in there and you pitch your idea to him and he goes, well, I mean, I can do that myself. Like, why do I need you? You have to be able to answer that. And so this taps into, well, what are your superpowers? What are the things that you have that nobody else has? It could be a skill. It could be some sort of, I don't know, dedication that you have, or some sort of expertise. Maybe it's a credential. I don't know. You have to figure that out. And the exercise I teach in the book, which is very difficult for a lot of people, is to go to your friends and family and the people that you know, and you ask them in a very nice way, hey, I'm doing some research, and I'm trying to figure out what my superpower is or what my specialty is. If you can reply to this email and tell me what you feel my strengths are, that would be really helpful. And you have to position it in a way. You don't want to go to your friends and go, hey, tell me why I'm awesome. Like, that wouldn't get a good response. But you'd want to go, hey, I need some help. I'm looking for how other people perceive me. What do you think my strengths are from your eyes? And thousands of people have done this exercise as a result of me sharing this. And what people get back often is very unexpected. Like, I had a woman who did this exercise. She sent this to a lot of her friends and family and colleagues, and even some of her clients too. And they were telling her that she was one of the most empathetic people that they've ever met, meaning they felt that she understood where they were. And she had never, ever considered that that was a thing that she was good at. It was just her natural way of communicating and being around people. So that really helped her understand how to position herself in a space where there's a lot of coaches. And it just made perfect sense, because when you're a coach, one element of a good coach is, can they put themselves in the shoes of the people they are coaching? And so now she's able to have more confidence when she goes to a client or a potential client and go, hey, you know, I know exactly where you're at right now. And because she knows how to do that. So that's just one example of the things you can learn by understanding what your personal superpowers are, because not everybody is like you. But it's so hard to know what that is just from yourself, because we're us. We need to know how other people perceive us. I had a number of people email me saying, you know, this exercise made me cry, because they were getting such amazing feedback from people that, again, that they never thought was there. Even one example brought a mother and their daughter closer together. It's just kind of random. But it's really important to understand what those superpowers are for you. And whatever those things become, whatever business you create, whatever ideas you have, you should include your superpower in there in some way, shape, or form. Like, you would be doing yourself a disservice if you didn't somehow incorporate what other people know you as for, or known, well, like they believe you're great at. That should always be included in what you're doing. That's going to help make your business stand out and help you have a unique selling proposition. So it starts with you again. Just like in the beginning, we talked about, okay, where do you get a business idea? Well, no, it starts with you first, and then it goes into your business. And it's the same thing with competitive advantages too.
Okay, you mentioned people that we are looking for at the beginning to find potential partners, people that we refer to. And if we start, they can all be our friends, because we are small, we are at the beginning, they don't consider us as competitors. But, you know, after some time, we grow, and we may want to start selling products similar to them.
Right.
So, isn't it risky, or isn't it easy to lost those friends you made at the beginning because of the natural growth of your business?
That's a great question. So, a couple things here. Number one, you can still generate an income without selling your own products. You can do what's called affiliate marketing. Most of the income that I've made over the years is affiliate marketing, because I have had these friends who have solutions that already exist. My audience has the same problems, and I go, hey, you know, John over here, he has a great product that will help you. Here's my affiliate link. And basically what happens is they go through that link, they buy John's product, and John pays me, you know, 50% commission essentially for sending my people over. So now we're both making more money as a result. So we're kind of teaming up and working together. That's an affiliate partnership, or sometimes known as a referral program. Now, there have been cases where I share another person's product, and then my own audience goes, Pat, I don't want John's product. I want you to teach me. And then you have to make a decision. Are you going to do that or not? And I would say that if you have made friends with somebody, that you should be very honest with them about the fact that you have this opportunity, and talk about how, you know, it's going to be on a case-by-case basis, but you could risk losing a friend as a result of that if you just create a legit, like literally a competing product, right? But there is a way, at least here in the US, a lot of people have this mindset of abundance, meaning, hey, you know what? The more the merrier. Like I use the word John specifically, because I don't know if you know I'm referring to John Lee Dumas.
Yeah, I know.
So John Lee Dumas had a podcasting course, he still does, called Podcasters Paradise. It's great. And I have this audience who now knows me as a podcaster as well, and they want to learn from me. So there's a dilemma there. Do I create a podcasting course or do I not? Well, for a while, I was always feeding people to John because I just didn't have the time. And that's the other benefit of affiliate marketing. You don't have to create those products yourself. And if you don't have the time, then, well, here's John's. And that was my answer for a while. But so many people in my audience were asking. I felt like I was not serving them by saying no. So the first thing I did was I went to John and I go, John, these people are asking me to create a podcasting course. And obviously, it would be in direct competition with yours. What do you think? And John goes, dude, do it. People want to learn from you. They're not going to buy my course. They're going to buy yours. And there are some people who will only buy from me. And so I was very thankful that John was also of the abundance mindset, because I can imagine somebody being very protective of that property. And so you kind of have to be careful about that. If you are really worried about that, there are other ways to work together. Let's say that I didn't create this course because I was afraid of what John might say. And John, if you're listening to this, thank you, because you're amazing. He's been super supportive. And guess what? Both of our businesses are flourishing. We did not take a hit from each other. And there's just this mindset of abundance out there. But let's say that I didn't want to do that. Well, maybe there's something I can create that can complement what he's doing. So I go, John, what about this idea? You have your course, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to coach podcasters one-on-one, or I'm going to have them come to San Diego, which is where I live, and we're going to do a group workshop, like a workshop together to go through this same kind of material, but for people who really need the handholding and the one-on-one help. Maybe I feed people over to your online course who don't want to come and meet me in person. So there you go. You win. You get those people. But then maybe you have people who don't want to learn in an online course. Maybe you can send them my way and we can work together that way. So you see how we're now developing a partnership as complementary products to each other instead of competing products. And so that's not how it went down. Actually, what happened on my end was I had a number of my own students go, hey, Pat, I think the course is great, but I wanted to learn in person from you. So I said, okay. So in San Diego, I hold a few times a year now what's called the Power Up Podcasting Fast Track Workshop, 2 days. 15 people come in for a lot more money than the online course, but we go through the whole course in 2 days. They have their podcast ready to go, and it's great. And so that could have been a solution if I was worried about a competing product. I can create a complementary product to the person. So that's just a specific example, but yeah. There's ways to work around it. You just kind of have to think outside the box sometimes.
All right. By the way, just a little side note. If you have people who would like to take a podcasting course in Polish, I do have one. So you can
there
send
you go.
Them to
Dude,
me.
Awesome.
Yeah. And the last question about business ideas. There are some people who would like to, or they say they would like to start a business, but they are paralyzed. They have this fear of failure and they are all the time worrying about what's going on, what's going to happen if they start the business, and they will fail with this, that, and that, and that.
Right.
Can you advise any ways to overcome this fear of failure?
Yeah, first of all, you ask really good questions, Marek. So
thank
if anybody's interested in taking your Polish podcasting course, I can already recommend it because you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
And I do thousands of interviews, by the way. But no, I love how deep you're digging here into this. If you fear something, that's good. That means it's important to you. I would be more scared if you were just like, oh yeah, this is going to be easy. Let's do it. The reason I'm scared of that is because you're likely not going to take the time and the effort to do it in a way that will actually work. You have too much confidence. So I like when the fear comes. Actually, for me, the fear was always something that stopped me also, because that told me, no, that's bad. Don't do that. But you have to think about where fear comes from. Fear comes from like avoiding death back in our, you know, Homo sapien origins. Like there's saber-toothed tigers and things that can kill us and eat us, right? So fear comes from and becomes a signal to us to not die. And you kind of still see this today. Like if like you're only born with two fears. You're born with the fear of falling and the fear of loud noises. That's it. And you know this because if you have a baby and you hold it, don't just take random babies to experiment with this. But if you have a baby and you're playing with it and you kind of pretend to fall with it a little bit, its arms jut out, like just instinctively its arms come out because it's trying to stop itself from falling or protect itself. And same thing with loud noises. If there are any loud noises, you see a baby startle and like kick and punch, and it's just built-in mechanism. All other fears we learn are brought into our lives from society, parents, experience in school, other failures we've had that just accumulate, just all those things. Which is really interesting because now we know that, well, these things weren't here to begin with. They somehow got into our lives so we can deal with it. They're not just a part of our innate nature. It's something that we learned so we can unlearn it and overcome it. And now I look at the fear as something that points me in the right direction. It used to stop me. It's why when I wanted to start a podcast in 2008, it took me 1.5 years to finally get my first episode up because I was scared. And man, I only wish I did it sooner because so many great things have always come out of it. And actually, when you think back in your history, likely some of the most amazing things that have happened in your life probably happened right on the other side of fear. Like think about when you jump out of a plane to go parachuting. You're most scared when you're in the plane before, like that's the, you're still safe when you're in the plane, but you're scared of what's coming. But then as soon as you jump off that plane and you're in free fall or you have that parachute, you're in the happiest place of your life ever. You're in bliss. And everybody who I've spoken to, because I am fearful of skydiving, just, I don't like heights. Because remember, fear of falling, it's built in. Everybody I've spoken to who's done skydiving has said the same thing. The scariest part is actually when you're still safe. The happiest part is when you are actually in the most danger, when you're actually free falling. Right? So just consider those things. I look at fear now and I go to it. This is why I knew I wanted to start speaking on stage because it was something I was deathly afraid of. And I did that and so many great opportunities have come as a result of that. And now when I start new businesses, I try to get to a point where I know I'm scared of it because that's how I know that it's big enough for me to pay attention to and focus on. I don't start anything where I'm like, oh yeah, this will be easy. I don't do that anymore. I always start things that are fearful. So if you fear the business ideas that you have, that's great. You can use the book or the things that we talked about today to make it less scary because now we're testing in an iterative process and you don't move on to the next step until you finish the previous one. And then the final piece of this, Marek, for everybody listening is guess what? You're going to fail. You're going to make mistakes. That's a part of the process. It would be amazing if you came up with an idea and everything went perfect all the way through. You would be Superman. That's just not how it works. If you think about some of the most successful business owners today, Elon Musk, he's gone through several failures in his past. Several. And even with Tesla right now, people would argue that it is failing, even though things are going well in certain areas. But anyway, he's still dreaming big and he's still getting things done. And, you know, that's what you got to do. You're going to fail. You're going to make mistakes. But as long as you keep getting up and learning from those mistakes, you're always, yeah, you're falling, but you're falling forward. So just keep that in mind. It's a rite of passage as an entrepreneur. And that's what separates you from the people who will always be dreaming. They will never take action. They will always say, well, you know, what if? Well, what? Let's get to the oh wells. At least you gave it a shot and you're always going to learn along the way.
All right. You mentioned public speaking. If your book is now published in Poland, is there a chance we'll see you on some stage in Poland?
Do you plan visiting Poland? I would love to. You know, my good friend Michal is over there, and he's trying to convince me to go there as well. And I'm, you know, I love him, and I'm looking forward to potentially doing a book tour or something next year. So yeah,
perfect.
Very likely.
All right.
Very likely.
Wonderful. So thanks a lot for sharing your great experience. And it was a huge, huge pleasure chatting with you. And I hope to see you in Poland next year.
I hope so too. Thank you, Marek. I appreciate you. Thank you all for listening in.
To był Pat Flynn. Linki do stron, gdzie można znaleźć informacje o nim oraz jego książkę Gotowi na start, zamieściłem w notatkach na maławielkafirma.pl/220. Ten odcinek, jak mówiłem na początku, był wyjątkowy. Jeżeli chcesz dowiedzieć się więcej o kulisach jego powstania, to zostań ze mną jeszcze przez kilka minut. Możliwość rozmowy z takim gościem jak Pat Flynn to chyba dla każdego podcastera zajmującego się marketingiem, przedsiębiorczością jest ogromne wyróżnienie, szansa i nobilitacja. Ale nie jest tak, że kiedy ta okazja się pojawiła, to ja od razu byłem na tak, od razu byłem zdecydowany. Miałem dwie spore wątpliwości. Pierwsza wątpliwość dotyczyła tego, że Pat jest w Polsce z pewnością przez wielu moich słuchaczy również mocno kojarzony z Michałem Szafrańskim i miałem takie obawy, czy zaproszenie go do podcastu nie będzie odbierane jako jakaś próba przejechania się na plecach Michała, próba wchodzenia w jego buty, podbierania mu przyjaciela i tak dalej. Porozmawiałem o tym z Michałem I on powiedział, stary, przesadzasz z tymi obawami. Nie sądzę, żeby ktokolwiek miał tego rodzaju wątpliwości, skojarzenia czy zarzuty, a jeżeli nawet, to kompletnie się tym nie przejmuj, dlatego że jeżeli masz fajny pomysł na tę rozmowę, to będzie twój gość i twoja rozmowa. I już, i temat załatwiony. Druga moja wątpliwość dotyczyła tego, że ta rozmowa miała być oczywiście po angielsku i nie od początku miałem pomysł, jak to zrobić, żeby mogli posłuchać jej wszyscy słuchacze małej wielkiej firmy. Zdaję sobie sprawę z tego, że nie każdy słuchacz małej wielkiej firmy zna angielski, a nie chciałem odcinać części stałych słuchaczy, tych, którzy są co tydzień z małą wielką firmą i słuchają każdego odcinka, nie chciałem im odcinać tej możliwości. Nie chciałem, żeby z powodu tego, że ten akurat odcinek jest po angielsku, gdzieś zgubili ten rytm, w którym są. Tutaj z kolei pomogła mi i podpowiedziała moja żona Ania, która mówi, słuchaj, ale przecież ty nagrywasz też te rozmowy w wersji wideo. Więc jeżeli wypuścisz wersję wideo z polskimi napisami, to nie ma żadnego problemu. To wtedy każdy będzie mógł sobie tę rozmowę odsłuchać w wersji angielskiej, ale przeczytać napisy po polsku i będzie w porządku. No i tak rzeczywiście ostatecznie zrobiłem, więc i Michałowi, który w ogóle umówił też tę rozmowę między mną a Patem, i mojej żonie Ani bardzo serdecznie dziękuję za pomoc przy tym odcinku. Jeżeli chodzi o samo nagranie, to miałem tremę jak nigdy wcześniej. Naprawdę nie sądziłem, że mogę być tak spięty przed rozmową w podcaście, no bo zrobiłem tych rozmów już też sporo. Pat oczywiście był bardzo, bardzo przyjazny i otwarty i bardzo szybko ta trema początkowa, jak mi się wydawało, zniknęła. Natomiast później, kiedy słuchałem nagrania tej rozmowy, to zorientowałem się, że no nie do końca zniknęła, dlatego że rzeczywiście właściwie w każdym pytaniu wyłapywałem od razu błędy językowe, które popełniłem. I mogłem te błędy łatwo usunąć, taka jest prawda. Mogłem nagrać te pytania jeszcze raz, wygładzić je, poprawić i wtedy brzmiałbym jak, no może nie jak rodowity Anglik czy Amerykanin, ale wyeliminowałbym te błędy i to wszystko wygładził. Natomiast nie chciałem tego robić. Nie chciałem tego robić z kilku powodów. Po pierwsze dlatego, że uważam, że to byłoby trochę oszustwo. Myślę, że siłą podcastów jest między innymi autentyczność i jeżeli zadając pytania się myliłem, no to nie ma powodu, dla którego mam udawać, że takich błędów nie popełniam. Popełniam je oczywiście i mam nadzieję, że z czasem będę ich popełniał coraz mniej, ale dzisiaj sytuacja wygląda tak, jak wygląda, zwłaszcza kiedy jestem spięty i onieśmielony obecnością tak znanego rozmówcy jak Pat Flynn, po pierwsze. Po drugie, to jest też coś, do czego ja staram się przekonać uczestników mojego kursu Podcast Pro. Nie starajcie się za wszelką cenę dążyć do doskonałości i odwlekać czegoś, co chcecie zrobić, aż to będzie idealne. Bo dużo lepiej uczyć się pracując, poprawiając to, co robicie. To jest zresztą też to, o czym Pat mówił w rozmowie. To podejście iteracyjne, to wypuszczanie kolejnych, coraz doskonalszych wersji. Ja też uważam, że to jest bardzo dobry sposób na rozwijanie się. No i trzeci powód jest taki, że jeżeli będę nagrywał z czasem być może kolejne rozmowy po angielsku i będę w tych rozmowach czuł się coraz pewniej, będę coraz mniej stremowany i one będą w związku z tym coraz lepsze, to dobrze mieć taki punkt odniesienia, taką dokumentację, jak to wyglądało za pierwszym razem, żeby się przekonać, że na przykład zrobiłem jakieś postępy. Także z tego powodu ten odcinek po stronie Pata jest świetny, po mojej stronie jest na pewno daleki od ideału, przynajmniej jeżeli chodzi o poprawność językową w języku angielskim, ale jeszcze raz, zrobione jest lepsze od doskonałego. Nie ja to wymyśliłem, to jest zdanie powtarzane przez wiele osób i myślę, że warto stosować je również w swojej firmie, w swoim biznesie i w swoim podcaście. Dlatego tak też zdecydowałem się zrobić. Dziękuję za pozostanie ze mną do końca, a jeżeli słuchasz tego odcinka zaraz po jego opublikowaniu, między 11 a 15 czerwca 2018, to mam jeszcze jedną wiadomość. Właśnie trwa sprzedaż mojego kursu Podcast Pro. To najlepszy sposób, żeby za pomocą podcastu budować swoją markę. Szczegóły na stronie podcastpro.pl. Zapraszam i do usłyszenia w następnym odcinku.
Subskrybuj podcast Mała Wielka Firma w swoim telefonie, żeby mieć dostęp do każdego nowego odcinka. Więcej informacji maławielkafirma.pl/podcast.